Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the road, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. It's beautiful outside. The sun is shining and it's not 1,000 degrees. But you're going to love this show. This is the last show of the summer season. I get back on the air on September 10th. I'm going to take a week off. But we've got a show to end this all show. This is going to be phenomenal. Jim Nesbitt is here, and the best lousy choice, and that's a hilarious title. You're going to get to know why. Deaths occur, but you feel sorry for those that fall. What about Bert S.P.I.? So unorthodox, and he's got so many flashbacks to his past. Even the scenes in the present were written in italics, and you could feel the tension within him before the explosion occurred. A book about money, power, greed, revenge, and one man named Bert, who is bent on finding the truth at all costs, and he'll tell you he made the best lousy choice. So good morning, Jim. How are you? And welcome to
the show. Well, I'm great. I'm great, and thank you for having me on your show. And it's hard to top that wonderful intro.
I try. I have to, you know. As a matter of fact, as Cheryl knows, I'm very fussy. I only interview people whose books are like 4 or 5 stars because they have to be quality writing. Otherwise, what can I say?
Well, I'm in exclusive company, and I'm even more
yes,
humble.
Yes, you are. Okay, so
you didn't have to agree so fast, Fran.
Of course I don't. You're wonderful.
Well, thank you.
But tell our listeners about your main character, Ed Earl Birch. Got that right. And why he lost his gold shield, and he gets into trouble a lot. My goodness.
Yeah, it's I continually throw him into the briar patch or the mesquite thorn patch out in West Texas and see whether he'll come out alive. Ed Earl is you know, I see him as kind of an everyman or everywoman, you know, just a common Joe or Jane that has been knocked around by life and may not be the smartest guy in the room, but he's cagey and pretty
mm-hmm.
quick, gets by on toughness and a little bit of recklessness and occasionally muscle. He's a
mm-hmm.
defrocked homicide detective in Dallas, and he's eking out a living as a private eye. I've set these books in the 80s and early 90s, and he gets a little niche market chasing after, you know, fugitives from the savings and loan bust back in the 80s that cratered Dallas, Denver, and a lot of other, you know, cities. But it's really work with no honor. He longs to get
mm-hmm.
his shield back. And he lost his shield because combination of things. He got blamed for the death of his partner. He got he's a little too quick to beat somebody up. And he's a terminal wiseacre who doesn't know when to shut up. So he got bounced off the force for cumulative reasons.
I wouldn't want to mess with this guy, that's for sure. I don't think so.
Well,
he's scary.
He's not a Sam Spade or a Philip
mm-hmm.
Marlowe. He's not super
no.
sharp. He's no dummy, but he's not, you know, he's not one of those guys with the quick answer, you know, right there. And he's not super cool like Steve McQueen's bullet. I mean, I just see him as somebody that who readers can readily identify with.
Yeah, he can. He's seriously, well, he's got a, you know, big mouth, and he takes no prisoners. That's me, too. What can I tell you? So that's
yep.
why I liked him, because he doesn't mince his words.
No, he doesn't. He's a straight shooter, and he pays the price for
yeah.
that. So,
I know.
Like all honest people do.
Well, what happens when he was in the service and he has nightmares? So, you know, I read some of them and I go, like, is that happening now? They get black, and it's flashbacks. So how does he deal with PTSD? Because that's hard, too.
Yeah, he is not diagnosed with PTSD, and he didn't see combat. He did an army tour, but, you know, that's kind of way back in his past. He basically is having nightmares from his, you know, basically the first book, his last case, where he was chasing a fugitive wrongly accused of murder and was teamed up with one of my favorite characters, Carla Sue Cantrell, who is into muscle cars, crystal meth, and 45 automatics. And they wind up going after a narco named Teddy Roy Bonifacio. And T-Roy is into kind of a mashup between voodoo and Aztec heart sacrifice rituals. And as a result, Birch almost got his heart carved out of his chest. And that's what gives him the nightmares, that he's got to hose down with Percodan and bourbon.
That's what we were just talking about, the Percodan, Vicodin, and Oxycodone company. We were just talking about that.
Yeah, and the time setting of the book is kind of before those things, you know, became known as problems. I mean,
yeah.
You know, got publicized as problems. I mean, Vicodin, Percodan, and the rest, you know, we know about them through the, you know, kind of late 90s and early 2000s through sports. Brett Favre getting, I think he got suspended for a while or had to go into rehab. And then now we have the full-blown opioid crisis, you know, that's, you know, kind of a nationwide horror show.
It is, and of course doctors are prescribing more and more, and they're encouraging patients to take them. I mean, and then they look at you as if you don't want to take them. You have to be out of your mind to take them.
Yeah,
so
that was... Yeah, that stuff has been heavily pushed since the time frame of the novel.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I remember taking either Darvocet or Percodan when I had various knee surgeries. Made me dream in Technicolor, but thank goodness I didn't get hooked on them.
No, thank you. I'll stick with Motrin. So he was working for a crooked lawyer. Why did he owe so much money, and what did he want him to do?
He's working for, I'd describe him more as a, you know, kind of a bottom feeder lawyer named Willie Nofsinger. And, you know, Birch got in debt trying to set up his business. He made some wrong choices and started owing people money. And Fat Willie, you know, kind of latched onto that debt and holds it over Birch's head, so that he can get him to take cases he doesn't necessarily want to take. And it's a very testy, contentious relationship. So Birch winds up doing things he really doesn't want to do, but, you know, he gets to move forward and live his life in a limited way as a result. So it's a uneasy truce between those two.
Oh, well. Now we have a character that I feel so sorry for. We have Bart Hewlett, and he's approached by, this could really happen, I know, by land developers, and they want to buy his land for $250 million, and he doesn't want to do it. So how do we know that the person that approached him wasn't going to take no for an answer? That is scary, because he should be able to decide for himself, but they weren't going to let him get away with that.
No, they want to take his ranch. I mean, Bart is a, you know, kind of a throwback. There are fewer and fewer Bart Hewletts in the world. You know, he's an old school West Texas rancher, and his family goes back into the, readily into the 1840s, which is, you know, kind of early in the, not too early, but you know, they're among the first folks who who settled that wild country out in West Texas, he's a war hero. He's the leading citizen of the town of Favor, which is a fictional town, and he was a former politician. And there's a lot to like about Bart, but his family has a kind of a deep, dark secret. They're divided between the so-called good Hewletts, which Bart is probably the lead mm-hmm. guy of, and the bad Hewletts, which are they're stone cold outlaws. And that side of the family is run guns, run drugs, run people. You know, done anything to make a dishonest buck you could think of, and. There's a great dichotomy between the two sides of the Hewlett family, and tension. But at the end of the day, they're family. There's that blood tie you can't sever.
I know that's scary, but this is an interesting book. Let me tell you. So, poor Bart, he didn't quite make it, did he?
No, I regretted killing him off.
Yeah, I liked
Bart,
yeah.
But I decided I needed something shocking to move the book forward.
It did, and then the guy that was supposed to kill him was really angry because he didn't get it the full amount that he wanted. You see, these assassins don't like when you do that. I know that.
Yeah, and that's another. I tend to get fascinated with minor characters who just kind of walk onto the page and kind of push their way forward. Vicente Roca, he's a hitman who uses needles that just as his method of dispatching people in a way that can't be traced. And he does. He's an interesting character. He's obsessive with his work and gets very possessive of the targets he's given and paid to kill. And when Bart winds up dead in another way, mm-hmm. he's very angry about that and wants to know who jerked his job away from him. He takes that very seriously. Murderously, I should say.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't want him to come. Oh, my God. He scared me sometimes, this guy. He's got
very elusive. He's very elusive.
Yeah,
he's not a big guy.
Yeah, I know.
But
he's got a very bad temper. You don't want to mess with this guy. Forget it. You just do what he says. Seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's an interesting, because Ederle's feeling him all along, kind of dogging his trail, but doesn't quite see him till a scene in a funeral home, and then he'll show up later on in the book. I don't want to give too much away, but and the guy, it's like a wisp of smoke. He's there, and then he isn't. So he's a very shadowy character, very elusive.
Well, we have people on the line. The phone lines are coming off the hook today. I don't know. Everybody loves me today for some reason. And so we have a sheriff. Unless I'm crazy about this guy. So he didn't want to, will he investigate it, consider it an accident? There was a fire, why not? I mean, seriously, what's his problem?
Yeah, Bart gets, killed in a suspicious barn fire.
Yeah.
And there are multiple suspects, a narco king who lives across the river, these hard-nosed developers who wanted to change his buy his ranch and change it into a kind of dude ranch and golf resort, and are infamous for not taking no for an answer. Could be some unknown guy from his political life or business life, and it could be family members. The sheriff. The sheriff is crooked. He's in bed with big narco king across the river. They reach an accommodation where pay off the sheriff for ignoring big shipments through the county as long as you didn't peddle the drugs in the county. And, it's a deal with the devil. because the guy's a former Texas Ranger, and he's got big plans to, you know, move up the political ladder and maybe governor, maybe somebody on the Texas Public Safety Commission. I mean, he's the Blue Willingham is his name, and he's a flawed and compromised lawman. He's kind of loosely modeled on a real life sheriff who got caught with his hand in the drug money cookie jar, and he's the face of a campaign, anti-drug campaign, Texas tough on drugs, yet he's in bed with a narcotraficante just across the river. He's also Bart's friend and protege, and Bart never knew about him being crooked, and his death pains him, but he feels like he, really can't aggressively investigate it because, it may be the narcotrafficante he's in bed with who pulled the trigger. So
yeah, I know.
That's how Ed Earl winds up getting asked by, one of the bad Hewletts, a guy named Jip Hewlett, to investigate
that, yeah.
The case. I mean, paid
well,
to investigate the case.
Yeah, I know. That's how he comes to a vote. But you know what? The good part about this book is that you can't trust anyone. Listen, you think you can trust? You can't. I read this and I go like, I don't trust any of these characters at all. And they all would take Earl and throw him off a bridge if they could. I know.
Yeah, that's the briar patch I continually try to throw Ed Earl into, and I'm often just as surprised as the reader about how he manages to, scramble away from the trap.
He manages, but he doesn't exactly come away unscathed. The poor thing. I mean,
he never does. I had a kind of a rule about, when I first created him, he never gets the girl, and he gets the bad guy, but he stays true to, he sometimes forgets his code, but he basically comes back around to it when the chips are down, and then he winds up with more pain, physical and spiritual, than he started out with.
I know. I go, ouch, a lot. And I go, like, oh, my God, that must hurt.
Yep.
So
fortunately, he's durable.
I hope, like the Ever-Ready battery, maybe he'll just, like, keeps going. What can I tell you?
Yep.
So, Birch
plus
Court.
It's fiction. It's easy to make him bounce back.
I know, seriously. Fortunately, maybe he needs a Teflon thing or a rubber vest or something. I don't know.
Now he's got his .45 and a leather covered sap, and he kind of makes do with that.
That is cool. So tell us, Birch is caught with another woman, and who is the woman, and how did he catch the wife? You don't think he's so innocent, people? Really?
If you're talking about the divorce case, pulls him out to West Texas. Yeah, he's tracking the wayward husband of a rich West Texas socialite who use the line attributed to Tanya Tucker, who has had more men than most folks have hot meals, and is into, she's a serial divorce person, and she's trying to get him tracked down so she can avoid paying him the full amount of a prenup they entered when they got married. That's what brings Ed Earl out to West Texas. The socialite has heard about him through some friends and gets Fat Willie to pull some strings to make Ed Earl do the type of case he loathes doing, which is divorce work. Turns out the woman who the husband is having a fling with is Bart Hewlett's daughter, Stella Ray.
Yep. So he's got a whole bunch of the scenes that you have with the females, whether they're flashbacks or whether they happen. How did you make them so explicit? It felt like I was watching it as it was going on. Seriously.
Well, I've always been a visual writer, and, you know, I want to show you rather than tell you. And I've also, when I started writing fiction, I also believed that, you know, I wanted to be frank about sex and violence, you know, instead of engaging in euphemisms. So my books are pretty salty as a result. But I think that's more honest than, I don't know, creating some symbolic, you know, wordplay for the for the male or female orgasm. I mean, James Lee Burke keeps on using tarpon leaping out of the surf for male orgasms. It just drives me nuts, as much as I revere him. So, and in terms of, thanks for the compliment, Fran, because you're telling me I've achieved what I was going for, which was
you sure did.
Put you right on the scene.
I could close my eyes. I could close my eyes and picture it.
You know, as a journalist, you know, I always wrote with the visual in mind and work well with photographers and graphic artists and videographers, and you know, would often offer to camp my stories if they're playing up a certain image. You know, I could kind of play that up in my story, and photographers were shocked when I asked that question, and I think that's carried over into my fiction. It's you know, it's one guy calls my books cinematic, and I think that stems from belief in setting a keen sense of place. You know, I'm the son of North Carolina hillbillies, storytellers, and grew up hearing the stories of family, friends, and mountain events from when I was very young. And you know, my parents instilled a keen sense of both family and place. You know, who your people are and where you come from. And you know, I think that's carried over into my fiction work. Well, it served me well as a journalist, and it's carried over into my fiction works.
Yeah, my mother was the same way. You will act this way, your morals will be this, you will not use bad language, and you will behave at all times. And you will call me wherever you are, from a payphone or a cell phone, or you will be grounded forever. No, seriously. I hear the voice in my head. It's terrible. Because my nieces live in Florida, and they live whatever. I text them every morning, are you in school behaving? And they text me back, yes. It's just a thing. They don't know why I'm doing it, but I'm doing it. But it's fun.
You know, you're an aunt who is concerned, and at the same time, you're
following
the dictates of how you were raised. You know, that's...
Well, I'm an educator by heart, so what can I tell you? So I that's it. And I'm also number one family homework term paper helper and researcher. I get to do everything.
Got it. Got it.
It is,
jack of all trades.
It's fun. Yeah. So you use a lot of flashbacks and graphic scenes, as we were saying. But this is why it was so good, because it heightened the suspense in the novel. How did that help? It does add to it, everybody. And the language, it sort of fits. It sort of fits. It sort of belongs there.
What I'm attempting to do is, you know, kind of give the reader a signal that either an action scene is happening or this is a flashback into the past by using italics. And you know, and I'll shift into present tense, you know, and write it the action scenes in a much more staccato, fragmentary fashion, and I think it serves to break up the book, give the reader, you know, clues as to what to expect in that italics passage, and he's going to do me another action sequence. Okay, goody. You know, and or this is a straight flashback, and I also use that for those conversations Birch has in his head with his dead partner. So those are the three reasons, and I think, you know, visually, it gives the reader kind of a gives the reader's eyes a break and signals a shift in the action.
Well, it's almost as if you included it as an audio part of the book. That's what I was thinking. I know
well,
I come up with things.
I've always believed that you should write in a conversational tone, write like people talk.
Uh-huh.
Not strictly so, you know, you got to clean it up, but
yeah, I know.
have that kind of, accessible language so that, for example, I'll read something back with a hand cupped to my ear, and if it doesn't sound right, you know, I'll go and rewrite it. Or if I've got to take too many breaths to finish a paragraph or sentence, and by holding a hand up to my ear, you remember the Laugh-In character, Gary Owens, who always did the old radio announcer bit?
Yeah, I know, Laugh-In, right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's who I'm imitating when I'm reading those passages back to myself.
Well, considering I don't write dialogue ever, because I don't do dialogue, I just write everything in the first person. It saves me the problem of having to do quotation marks. But to be very honest, if I want to hear how something sounds, I'll take my video thing or my tape, and I'll tape it so they can hear it back. Or I tell somebody to read it and tell me, what do you think? How do I fix this? Because Fran doesn't do dialogue. She just writes everything as if it's happening to the person right then and there. It's so much easier. And my editor loves me because she doesn't have to deal with my quotation marks and my rotten dialogue.
To me, in fiction, I kind of follow the Raymond Chandler rule. You drive the story with characters, action, and good snappy dialogue, either internal or between two characters or more. And that's kind of a dance where you get another opportunity to show who these people are rather than tell. And character, I think, is revealed in dialogue. Character is revealed in action. Character is revealed in kind of the landscape they're moving through. So, Cormac McCarthy and George V. Higgins dumped quotation marks a long time ago, and I always found reading their books was like stepping into the middle of a conversation with strangers who talk in a unfamiliar dialect. And it takes you a while to get used to the rhythm, I'm trying to make it easy for the reader,
Well, you did. I could tell actually who was speaking. I've read over 10,000 books. No, seriously, in the last 10 years, my husband counted on my computer how many reviews I did. I could, oh, my God. And sometimes the writer writes it in such a way they go like, who is that? Who's speaking?
Yeah.
Who are you? Well, I just write from the point of view of the dead person that did something.
Yeah.
And they speak, they speak, and they. I don't need to write the quotes, but we have a character we'd like to know more about, and she's one of the Hewletts, Sarah. Tell her about her and her family. They're really, I don't want to be part of that group at all. Ooh.
Are you talking about Stella Ray?
Yeah, Stella Ray.
Stella Ray. She, I used her for, two things to show just, that classic family dynamic where the, kind of an unrequited love between daughter and father and just how, twisted that can become. She's like a bit of a wild child and is in, an affair with a married man. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And, and she's brainy and smart, but she, wants to be close to her father, and he keeps holding her at arm's length. And she loves the land and, finds out he's been talking about selling it or putting it in trust to like the Nature Conservancy, and it really kind of torques her badly. I'm not going to say anything more along those lines because it would be revealing too much.
Well, you guys got to read this book because the title alone is hilarious. It just sort of says everything. So
I've kind of painted myself into a corner. The first book was called The Last Second Chance. The second book was called The Right Wrong Number, and then I came up with The Best Lousy Choice, and now it's going to be a challenge to top those or remain consistent for title of the next book.
You could always write, I had no choice. What can I tell you?
Yeah. But it's an old, something I admire about John Prine's songwriting.
Yeah.
You know, Prine will lead you right up to the edge of what you expect is, you know, will be a cliche. And he takes a sharp left or right turn and turns the cliche into something smart and original. And so, not that I share any universe with John Prine, but that's kind of what I had in mind when I write my titles.
All I could tell you is that I do all the interviews and book reviews mostly for Partners in Crime, and then Cheryl just said, you're doing this and reading it. Seriously. I had no idea. I just said, okay. There were a couple that I turned down because I'm like bogged down. I said, but this one was different. I said, oh, well, okay.
Well, I take that as, again, high praise, and I thank you very much.
It is. Punky Barnes, Burkhardt, and Bordelais Quarles, who are they? And how many people were involved in this land deal? Poor Bart, I really liked him. Maybe he can resurrect him from the dead.
Yeah, Punky Barnes is a relatively minor character who is the mentor of the barn burner, Charlie Burkhardt, and Charlie is just getting out of prison in Kentucky, where Punky picks him up at the gates, and the guy who got Charlie caught was a loudmouth realtor named and condo king named Bordelais Quarles. So I kind of, you know, had to set up and give a little background on Burkhardt to kind of, you know, flesh him out a little bit. And that's those are the characters I threw in to give you some backstory on Charlie.
There you did. But we have another guy that scared me, and he's very dangerous, and you don't want to mess with Lucius Schoenfeld. Why did he want the land? And I don't like him. And he didn't like my poor Ed Earl. He didn't like his questions. Too bad.
Yeah, that's true. I wouldn't describe him as a scary character. He's the
scary
point man for the more, you know, for the bad boy developers who are based in Houston. You know, he's a local lawyer, and you know, he keeps he's kind of the cat's paw that they use to kind of try to negotiate and bully Bart into selling his land, and he winds up getting into Ed Earl's crosshairs because Ed Earl quickly gets on the trail of the possibility that the developers killed Bart, and that's how he winds up in Ed Earl's crosshairs.
So we have Carla Sue. Why did Carla Sue, have to talk about her, deal with Gaza, and why did she lead him on? No, that's not nice, but she was smart.
Well, the first she came up, and it's one of those situations you get into where, I meant her to be a minor character in my first book, and then she just busted out and took over and, you know, jumped onto the computer screen and said, "Move over, fat boy, I'm taking up residence." And, I just had a blast writing her. She's very smart, very much into betraying people after she's gained their confidence and either winds up killing them or definitely taking their money or taking over their business. And she, in the first book, she and Ed Earl are, both hunted for murder that they didn't commit and also tracking down their mutual enemy, the border narco called T-Roy. And I brought her back for this book because she's doing what she does, you know, sucking up to one narco and helping him set up another for a takeover. And she's just, you know, kind of a wily, tough woman who enjoys that, you know, walking that high wire double cross.
Well, she's really interesting. I liked her. Sorry. I hope you bring her back.
Well,
I like her.
You're not the only one. I've got a buddy of mine in Bakersfield who keeps telling me, are you going to bring Carla Sue back in this book? So I sent him a note after I introduced Carla Sue in this book and said, your wish has been fulfilled.
Yeah, she sort of adds to the dynamic of the plot, and I like her attitude. She's really good. She's
tough. I mean, I've been asked the past, you know, the most of my women characters are very tough.
Yeah.
Not afraid to get their hands
mm-hmm.
dirty in terms of either committing some violence or some criminal acts. And you know, I got asked why do I do that? And I'm like, I'm writing bloody tales of revenge and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
All these people need to be tough. You know, gender doesn't matter. You know, and they're great fun to write because they're smarter than the men.
They're
able to, you know, get them dancing on like puppets on a string, and they're just as ruthless and willing to, you know, kill or commit a criminal act to get what they want. So, and I think they're great fun to write.
I liked about it, because she didn't make the female character a wimp. I hate that.
Yeah.
That drives me crazy.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, you know, I'd always rather deal with strong, smart, sharp women, and usually they're far smarter than me. And I'm married to one now. So,
you admit that.
Yeah, I mean, readily admit it, you know. So, I mean, you know, it's no... Everybody else can figure it out pretty quickly, so why not cop to it? You know,
well, my nephews and my nieces think I'm smart. I keep telling my husband I'm a genius. Well, what can I tell you? You know, maybe, you know, you just don't know. But before I forget, September 10th, I've got a panel show. We're going to be talking about different types of ways to publish books. It's going to be Alan Topel, Vincent Zandri, Matt Coyle, and Larry Thompson. And we're going to talk about the one complaint I have when I get a book to read, that the font is too small and I need a magnifying glass to see it. A lot of publishing companies are skimping on pages. So the books that are like, you know, 200 pages, I don't even read them. Either that or I get permission, and it costs me money to get them printed out so I can read it. Otherwise, I don't do it. Okay, and on the 16th, we have Allison Brooke, a.k.a. Marilyn Levinson, Buried in the Steps. And someone else you might know from the Thriller Fest, Reese Hirsch, The Black Nowhere. And someone else that I was honored to meet last year, Shannon Kirk, Gretchen. That book is so scary. I mean, really scary. We have William Embry, The Ornery Jean, on the 24th. And to finish September, Catherine Riggs, What She Never Said. MJ Network gets everybody. And we're going to get some really unbelievable people in October, so stay tuned, people. So, who is Felipe, and what information does he help to help our Ed Earl and Doggett? We didn't get to him yet, that one.
Well, I'm thinking you're either meaning Vicente or you're...
Yeah.
Or who's the assassin, or Eduardo Lopez, who is the guy who fingers Bart for seeing a drug shipment coming into the Bad Hewlett side of the ranch, and really, you know, puts their property in peril if they ever got caught. Eduardo's kind of a fringe player. He is a wannabe. He wants to, he wants to be part of one of the Narco Traficante's crew, and they kind of view him as an errand boy, and it ticks him off. And he's the guy who sees notices that there's somebody up on the ridgeline above where the plane is flown in to offload drugs, and he winds up ratting out Bart, who's up on the ridgeline watching this all go down. He winds up ratting him out to the narco across the river, who, in an attempt to ingratiate himself to the boss.
This is a question I've never asked before, but this is really interesting because you've got a couple of killers in here, hired killers. How do you create a hired killer? I mean, Ronaldo, I liked him. Feel bad for the poor guy. And he got gypped.
Yep.
So how do you create the person that's going to take the person down, the killer? And does the killer, the hit person always get away with it, or do they wind up realizing he shouldn't have done it?
Well, in this one, three gunmen, get killed in various ways, and I think the easy way to do it is create either a guy who's always been a criminal and he happens to be a hitter. Or, ex-cop who gets into private security and then steps over into the darker side of that for, corporations or wealthy players. And Bartel, who no first name given or asked for, he's that kind of guy, ex-cop. Was into security work and gets hired as muscle by the land developers. Mm. So, and he's also brought in to babysit Burkhart when they're trying to find out, how Bart wound up getting killed. That was supposed to be a fire that just was supposed to scare Bart into signing his ranch over, and it went wrong, and they want to find out why. And he's babysitting both Burkhart and Schoenfeld, the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you do any research into land developing and how this happened?
A little bit,
a
little bit, but I didn't want to use too many details because that.
Mm-hmm.
That winds up that wouldn't have moved the book forward. As a reporter, I'd done some stories on bad land deals, crooked land deals, and land deals between county government and big corporations. So I kind of knew that turf and how those guys think and act, and then just kind of. Since it was a minor plot point, just kind of winged it from there. Apparently, I did okay.
Apparently, you must have done okay, because otherwise, so many people wouldn't want to read the book. And if they're not reading it,
that's a good point.
I
mean, you do research, mm-hmm. and you research more than what you're going to use. And the reason you do that is not to put not to do a data dump in your book, but so that you'll know and can be authoritative in the pieces you choose to use. And and the more, I learned this as a reporter, facts are your friends. And the firmer, the more facts you've got, the firmer foundation you've got for your writing. It's kind of counterintuitive. If you've got a firm foundation based on solid mm-hmm. research, your writing really takes off and flies. Whereas if you don't, you're kind of writing around stuff and making stuff up, and that weakens the writing. And I know guys who they'll put every jot and tittle of something that they've researched into the book, and it's like, man, this is not an encyclopedia. You're telling a fiction story. And the reason for the research is as much to tell you what to put in, and so you know what to also take out, you know, that you can omit without it wrecking that authenticity you're going for.
I agree with you, and I've read historical novels, and sometimes the plot loses something when they do too much history. And then I say, well, aren't you going to write about the character and what's supposed to happen? And I know you're in historical times, and sometimes I go, oh, God, no, and I skip over it. Or sometimes I skip over the plot because the plot's so bad, I go, like, I don't want to read that either.
Yeah, and I feel the same way when you're trying to set a keen sense of place. You know, you're not doing a travelogue. You know, you're trying to, you know, make that scene so vivid that it's not just it's not a theater flat backdrop. It's almost becomes a character unto itself because it's always fascinating to watch people and the land they move through, or, you know, it doesn't have to be rural. It can be the city they move through, and how that affects them and how they deal with that. I mean, that's another way to reveal character, and, you know, the interplay between the land and the people that are living on it.
Well, that's a good point because, like I said, I read too many books, and sometimes the author writes the scenery and it takes away from the story, and the scenery becomes the plot, and I go like, help! And you know what? The other thing I can't stand, I don't mind flashbacks at all. When you know, like, you put them in italics, so I knew it was a flashback. But when I get a book, and in the middle of the page, I say, like, wait a minute. I was just reading this, and what is that? And it's a flashback, or it's another character, or it makes no sense. And I go, like, I don't even want to deal with it. That's the worst. So
I mean, you have to be judicious about these things, and you have to help the reader out. You know, I'm not a big timer like George V. Higgins or Cormac McCarthy, so you know I want my readers to continue reading the book and buy the next one. So I think it helps them out. You know, using italics, it also breaks up the copy and gives them a little bit of a breather.
Well,
you know,
I think that also have a girlfriend. I think he needs a girlfriend in the next book or something.
You're not the first.
Or a bodyguard. I think he needs something to prevent himself from falling apart and getting killed. I'd be black and blue. Oh, my God.
He is, and, you know, he's getting, well, in this novel, he's not as long in the tooth as he was in my second novel. I've set the, chronologically, this book takes place between the first novel and the second novel, and he's not as long in the tooth as he is in the second novel. But I'm reaching the point where, you know, he's a guy, you know, at this point in time, you know, he's in his 40s, you know, and you know, soon to be in his 50s, and then, you know, that all that physical damage is going to take a toll. So it's something I'm going to have to deal with, you know, in future books if I keep him going.
Well, you may have to get an orthopedic surgeon as your consultant at the rate you're going.
Well, and that would be autobiographical because I'm looking at getting knee replacements and hip replacements in the not too distant future.
I'm looking
after,
to
after
figure
eight
out
knee
how to
surgeries.
Get my I know what you're saying. No,
go ahead.
You don't really want to do it. Do you really want to do a knee replacement?
I don't know. I mean, it's after eight knee surgeries, there's no cartilage in there anymore. So you know, sooner or later, I'm going to have to at least face that music and make a decision.
No, I don't want any more surgeries. I've had my fill. No. My ring finger on my right hand doesn't love me. It only, you know, falls like half away. I can't bend it all the way. And I just explain to it every morning, why are you going to let me type? And it does. So that's it. That's my cure. Forget that.
There you go. Everybody's got to, you know, have their mojo and their magic words to make the body function. I talk to my knees all the time.
I know. I speak to my little hand, and I'm just, that's it. I'm not going to do anything about it. I wouldn't want to upset it. So the final things. How did you create them and take down so many people? And what about Birch? He's a private investigator, and yet he's able to skirt the law. In real life, could that happen?
I doubt to the degree of my fiction, but I think he's got a, you know, he's got a bit of a license because he's, you know, he's not a not carrying a badge, even though he'd dearly like to, have a gold shield again. And yeah, I'm aware that he's doing some, you know, he's basically and is self-aware of this. You know, he's basically walking on the outlaw side of the tracks, and you know, thinks about it periodically through the book. And short answer is no, Fran. Of course not. But you know, I'm writing fiction so I can get away with it and make it a more violent and tense situation.
Well, you have to, because you know, too boring. What can I say?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the guy that I really felt bad for was Ronaldo. I felt so bad for him.
You mean Chewy?
I liked him, though.
Well, why did you like him?
He was so sure that he could do the job, and he really wanted to do it. And then he gets worked. Because I didn't like Vincent Roca at all. No. So,
yeah.
I liked him.
Chewy's an interesting guy, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he's somebody who doesn't look a bit of a schlub. I mean, he doesn't look threatening or anything. You probably look at him and forget you saw him a nanosecond later. But I was trying to create a guy that kind of like Birch, you know, people ignore or take for granted or don't think very much of, and they wind up paying a price for that. And he's, you know, he's a killer who likes to, you know, and does wet work for, you know, Malo Garza, who's the narcotrafficante across the river. And, you know, he's ticked off that that Malo's, you know, chosen this other guy to come in because he thinks that's his job to take care of, you know, any problems for Malo Garza.
It's almost like ego, sort of.
Oh, very much so. I mean, these are guys, and it's like,
I know,
you know. So it's like ego, and you know, in all its manifestations, for good or evil, or good or stupid, you know, that's what drives these guys. I mean, Blue Willingham is, you know, tremendously ambitious, so he sells his soul. You know, all these guys have got egos and confidence.
So my question is, we have about 5 minutes. Where do you see him next? And is he ever going to get his shield back, the poor guy? Or we're just going to keep him as a dangerous private investigator that many of us would like to hire for other reasons. You never know.
Yeah, because he's not shy about shooting people.
No, definitely not.
that's what I'm wrestling with right now. I mean, I have him as a Dallas PI, but I keep throwing him into the mesquite thickets of the Hill Country and Northern Mexico and West Texas. So I'm toying around with a way to bring him out to West Texas permanently, or you know, at least for a book or so, and that's probably what I'm going to do for book four. And I'm thinking about, let's see whether he gets a badge back as part of the package. And that's about as far as I've gotten in terms of thinking about the fourth book.
Well, besides Carla Sue, because you have to bring her back because everybody said so, who else are you bringing back in the next book? Anybody else? You're going to bring Stella Ray back, too?
There's a character that's in book one and two that people like. He's a Houston homicide investigator named Cider Jones, who, he and Ed Earl don't like each other a whole lot. And, Cider is kind of a nemesis and has tried to, has pursued Birch for murder and is convinced, he's still convinced Ed Earl committed a crime. And, in book two, pull strings as Birch is, you know, moving across Texas again, to see if he can set Birch up for either an arrest or to get killed. So I think it's time to bring back Cider. He's a pretty popular character.
Okay, and before we end, where can everybody find out about all of your work and what you do and where we can find out more about everything? And I'm sure, you see, this is, I don't even ask anymore. I'm sure when you write the book, Cheryl's just going to say, I'm sending it. I know.
Yeah.
I don't even have to ask.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I can feel it in my bones. You're going to get it anyway. It doesn't matter. So don't bother to ask. What can I tell you? So where can we learn more about you and your work? Seriously.
Well, you can go to my website, and that's jimnesbittbooks.com, and, you know, see a description of, you know, probably read your fill about me and my books. They're all available on Amazon in Kindle and paperback. This third book is also – no, actually, all three books are available on Nook. And then this book is available on Kobo and Apple Books. So it's out there, and you've got the full panoply of options depending on what electronic device you're addicted to, or if you just like a paperback and go old school and for that tactile feel.
I will not read or review a book that's not in print.
There you go.
We're
simpatico on that point. It ain't
a
book.
I won't, and it's not, to me, it's not, besides the fact that if I have to interview the person, I have to have the book in front of me so I can underline, circle, and destroy the book. You can't even read the book after I read. Actually, my UPS guy loves me. My postman thinks I'm the coolest thing on 2 feet. So your book is going to Wiz when he comes to deliver my next package. He's my UPS guy, and he takes all my murder mysteries. That's probably why.
Well,
thank
you, Fran. You're creating another Ed Earl fan.
This is very true, and I don't do that very well. Yeah, I do. Not really. I'm hoping to create a few myself on Sunday. Silent Voices is coming out on a blog tour with Partners in Crime. So for those of you that haven't read it, it's really good. I've got 6 5-star reviews, and I'm hoping that more people like it. You don't expect 5 stars every single time, but I hope we get more than 3 or 4. You never know. But it's told from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone. The first 2 stories are based on information that I got about my grandmother's. That's all I'll say about that. And one, you can actually figure out which other one is true. And the other 4, like I said, are my imagination, but they're told by the character. Either somebody did something wrong to them and put them there, or somebody, they did something wrong and deserved to be there. What can I say? So I want to thank you so much, Jim. This has been fun. Do you do panel shows? Seriously?
I have done them in the past, and I enjoy it. I mean, I don't know whether I'm any good at it, but I enjoy, you know, particularly radio, because I've got a, you know, face built for radio, and you know, just that, you know, you're carrying it with your words, and you're painting a picture with your voice. So, and that marks me as being decidedly old school, I guess. But I really thank you for having me on, and appreciate the opportunity, Fran.
You're very, very welcome. Everybody, it's a beautiful day outside, but if you don't know what to do, pick up a book. Pick up this book, Best Lousy Choice. Pick up a book and read. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.